Hiya. Just dropping in here before our Oscars 2021 special with two quick points on this week's show. First, a content warning. In our review of Promising Young Woman, we inevitably touched on themes of sexual assault. There's nothing overly graphic or detailed in our discussion, but if you'd like to give the segment a miss, the review goes from around the 14 to the 30 minute mark, and we put the exact timestamps for it in the podcast description. Second, we had some technical difficulties in the studio, so apologies for the audio in the first 20 seconds, but it clears up significantly after that. Also, we had an audio dropout issue during the Promising Young Woman review, but we managed to pull through, as you'll hear in the podcast. So, I hope you enjoy this week's show.
On campus.
And online.
Online.
This
is
URN.
Hello, unfortunately I had to fade out a bit of Elton John there, but we're back with a film show. And I'm just going to turn everybody up, so hopefully we can hear across the airways of Skype. Hello, Lizzie and Isaac. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Oh, hi. Yeah, hey. I think that's all okay. So yeah, we're back in the studio just for this one, and I think for the remaining ones at least, that should all be okay. Just kind of get back to grips with the studio. But yes, today we're going over the Oscar special. So we're going to talk about the Best Picture nominees, at least the ones that we've seen, and some of the other films that have been nominated and will be, chosen in, I think it's this Sunday's award ceremony. So, and we were going to start off with a fantastic film, in my opinion, that I watched last night, I think. Or was it night before? But it's Sound of Metal. I mean, am I right doing the synopsis on this?
Yes, you are the designated metalhead.
Yes. You are, please go for it.
This was really an experience for me, Sound of Metal. It was, Sound of Metal. I think it was actually finished in around about 2018, but only now just getting a release. I
know. Yeah, it premiered at festivals in late 2019, but obviously it got delayed with COVID, and now it just came out recently.
Yeah, so it's about Riz Ahmed's character, who's a drummer in the band Blackgammon, who suddenly loses hearing. And it's kind of a look into the deaf community, and especially how it relates to kind of the American medical system, as well as just kind of a general film about, how such a life-changing thing can, set you off and either dredge things up from your past, or, in fact, change your future, I suppose. Sound of Metal, and it's being nominated as Best Picture, and I think Best Sound. I'm looking through my notes. I don't have it in my notes.
Best Screenplay, I think. Best Actor for Riz Ahmed.
Yes, yes.
Best Supporting Actor for Paul Reese, and I can't remember the other one.
Yeah, I'm just getting up now. Hopefully. Right. That's right, yeah. So it's kind of, for me, I mean, watching it, I kept having to think, there's a lot of films in the Oscars, and we'll get on to kind of stuff, or specifically Mank and Trial of Chicago 7, that feel, like films. They've got that kind of slight bombast to them. They've got, they look expensive. Not expensive, but they look...
They're film with a capital F.
Exactly. Mm. Whereas this, I mean, it's probably not one of the... it's probably not the most indie film out there. It's still a little bit, it has a narrative, and you can kind of follow it through. But the film's use of, of dialing back kind of the cinematic techniques, and especially its focus on sound, really makes it, for me, stand out from a lot of the other films. Because, I suppose within the narrative, it's that Riz Ahmed's character goes from this world of noise metal and, real, intense drumming and into the quiet of the deaf community. And how the film kind of uses sound, especially, I don't really want to... get too much in detail, because it is a wonderful film, and you can watch it on, I think it's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, Amazon Prime.
In differences between Riz Ahmed's character's perceptions of sound, and how that's reflected through the film's use of sound effects, and in fact, subtitling. And I know Riz Ahmed was talking about, on an interview, that in cinemas, and I think in the festivals, it was open captioned, so there was captions burnt onto the screen, for the entirety of the film. And I think that use of captioning and kind of tackling the idea of deafness with a, I think, again, on the interview, so with a capital D, that it's an identity rather than any kind of disability. And I love how it tackles that within the film, because, you know, in a traditional film that might be, say, tackling this kind of thing where a drastic life change happens, it might focus, you know, on too small a range of what's going on, like doing it on a more kind of just focusing on that character. Whereas this film, I think, really does tackle those kind of big topics of the medical system and how it deals with such long term conditions. And
I think it's more broad. Like, it can be a little more broad, because like, obviously the film has got sound. It's titled, and audio does play a massive role, you know, both in the narrative and for the characters. But I thought what was interesting was, like, the first few minutes of the film was that it just, like any great movie, like, it just establishes a day in the life of our main character. Like, aside from, you know, playing drums in a metal band, you know, we see him, you know, he lives on the road in a mobile home. He makes movies, you know, he's in a loving relationship with his girlfriend, yeah, Lou, played by Olivia Cooke.
Yeah,
and then very quickly, like, these things that are very, you know, admirable, you know, like, what seems like a perfectly lovely way of living is quickly taken away from him. So the film really is about this kind of, it's about adjustment with something so severe, when something that's so significant, you know, sound is significant to everybody, you know, who is able to hear. But when you're a musician, for that sound to be, if not gone, to be completely drastically, you know, like, changed, it changes your entire life, and not just the way you go about it, the way you perceive it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and I think that was kind of one of the things I was hesitant about going into the film, that it wouldn't be able to set up the characters of Ruben Stone and Lou Berger, Riz Ahmed and Libby Cook, and their relationship. And, you know, as you were saying, the prior life before he loses his hearing. But I think the way it jumps into the gig, and, well, not rushing it exposition-wise, but really, as you're saying, set that sense of normalcy within, you know, not a very normal life, kind of life that they're living, you know, they're going around touring back a camper van, but that you can feel, you know, that sense and have it taken away from you. And I think it's in the first 20 minutes or so. It's not like it's a full first act where it's just establishing, and then first act to second act it's introduces and going deaf. But I think develops his characters really well, and to kind of pull the rug from under you. And it is a very emotionally
taxing
film.
I think this is like the first, like, leading role from Riz Ahmed, which really, like, shows his talents as an actor, because, you know, he's always a reliable actor. Like, we all know he's really, really good. And then, you know, and some of my favorite roles is in when he was in Four Lions back in his day, and Nightcrawler. Like, these are all great roles and great performances, but they're supporting roles, or, like, you know, part of an ensemble. But this feels like he is, like, the key focus of the film, even though there are other characters. And, like, you know, just this kind of, like, kind of when he's getting tests for his hearing after it just deteriorates really rapidly, like, you can sort of, I don't know, like, he can sort of sense, like, he kind of knows what the situation is, but, like, he just doesn't want to accept that he's in denial, because sound is, and hearing is so important to him.
It's heartbreaking. The use of silence and just letting Riz Ahmed, you know, face, well, actually, all the characters, because it's, you know, there's not a huge amount of dialogue in this film, and letting the characters, you know, emote with having that silence there is doubly, you know, important in this film, where it's so reliant on sound. But having these amazing actors, Riz Ahmed, Olivia Cooke, and Paul Racy, I think, Paul Racy as the leader of the addicts society, the recovery group of deafness and also addiction, and his character is wonderfully, you know, low key to a certain extent. You can feel the confidence within him, but also the fragility of the relationships that he's having with the community, and how deafness impacts, you know, not just how you participate around the world, how you participate with others around you, but how you view yourself, and how you kind of, again, deafness with a capital D, your identity itself.
Yeah, it's interesting, because, like, when the sound of the film, like, there's kind of how the film portrays, you know, hearing loss. It's not like, you know, like, you know, usually it's something that's considered scary, a scary sound in this film is something that's very high pitched, or, you know, very loud. But usually when that's the case, it's very, very short and brief. But in this film, it's kind of like a low kind of muffled drone. And like, to me, that's as effective as what I just said a minute ago. And it is like, it's almost like, even though the film's not in real time, it's like this kind of, you know, the sound is very subjective, even though there's objective hearing, like there's like, you know, there's like what other people can hear, but like it really kind of focuses on sort of, you know, like Riz Ahmed, you know, how he hears the world. And I think it's something we should actually do, because rarely on the show we don't really talk about sound, but we don't really mention, you know, key people who work in sound. So I think we should, you know, for a film that's all about, you know, sound, we should shout out some of the sound people that have been nominated. So we have Nicholas Becker, Jamie Baskert, Michelle Kutenlenkuk, sorry if you put your name, Carlos Cortez, and Philip Ladd.
I can't think why, you know, what is going to stop them winning the Academy Award for Best Sound, to be honest.
I think it's not just the fact that it's like, oh, it's a film about sound, so it's like, it seems obvious. It's what you do with the sound, like, especially again, the different, like, again, there's like one of my favorite moments of sound in the film is this kind of this transition later in the film where you hear what everyone else hears, but then you hear what he hears. And it's actually kind of pretty late in the film, like in the third act. And it is like really kind of heartbreaking to see. And it also kind of makes you reconsider like music, not just as sound, but as the sense of touch. When he goes to this sort of shelter for people who are deaf but are also recovering addicts, like there's like a bit where he's like teaching kids like music and drums, but obviously because they can't hear, they have to use vibrations of these little like kind of I don't know what you call them, like little buckets in a classroom. And it shows like sometimes that like touch is kind of something, it doesn't seem very obvious, like touch is really important in music. And just to give a little tangent, because I think this would be a really interesting aspect for deafness and music, is that at Grateful Dead concerts, they would have this area of shows called Deaf Zone, where deadheads who were deaf, they instead of hearing the music, they would feel the vibrations of it through balloons predominantly. Mm. And what there also was an interpreter. And they would sign language the lyrics of the music that was playing. I just think when I was thinking of the story, I think it'd be just a little interesting tidbit about deafness in music, which seems like a paradox, but it isn't.
Yeah. I mean, with this film, I think we should just about wrap up on it. But yeah, you can kind of imagine, you know, talking about a rural deaf community where he goes in and helps children. You could feel it maybe becoming a bit, well, no. In the aspect that with this kind of plot, you could feel there are lots of traps they could fall into where it becomes too, you know, emotionally manipulative. But definitely that use of silence and relying on the sound design to push that emotion through to you, I think is honestly one of the best films of the year, I suppose. That's why it's
the best. I enjoyed it as well. Can I just say, hopefully there's a sequel where he plays drums, but instead of like affecting his hearing, he plays with brushes. I think it could either be called Sounds of Metal or Sound of Metal 2, Sound Quieter.
Right.
And also, I know this seems in bad taste, but like when he hears how a snare sounds when it's really muffled, I will say it sounds better than the snare in Saint Anger, the Metallica album.
Oh, we'll get into that on my metal show. Exactly.
Would you agree with me, John, that the snare is better than Saint Anger?
The drumming is absolutely amazing. I will get there.
Oh, yeah.
I love Blackgammon's music. Like, I wish they were a real band. But anyway, yes, so we're going to move on now from Sound of Metal to another nominee, and that is Promising Young Woman. And Lizzie, I know you've seen this very recently. Would you like to give a synopsis of this?
Yeah, sure. So Promising Young Woman is about a woman named Cassie, played by Kerry Mulligan. She's about 30 years old. She just turns 30 in the film. She's a med school dropout. She's living with her parents and she's working in a coffee shop. And her life kind of isn't really going anywhere. And you slowly start to find out that the reason she's kind of dropped out and done all of this is that when she was at university or college or whatever they call it in America, her friend Nina was assaulted. And the situation was not handled well, to put it mildly. And it is heavily implied that as a result of that, her friend who was assaulted, Nina, is no longer with us. So this is kind of plaguing Cassie's existence. And as you can kind of see from any trailers to do with this film, it sets up the concept very quickly that what she starts to do is to go out to bars kind of every night, and she acts completely blackout drunk, and she waits for a quote-unquote nice guy to come and kind of look after her and put her in a car to go home. And pretty much every single time they get in the car, they find out that really there's no one around, there's no one to watch them, there's no one to stop them. These men can take advantage of the situation if they want to. So that's like the basic premise. I kind of don't want to say too much more than that, even though that's already quite a lot. It's a really interesting film. I watched it this week. You can watch it on Now TV if you have that at the minute, the subscription, or you can get the 3-week trial, which is what I did. spoilers. Sorry, Now TV. I've really tried to come to terms with this film all week, and I don't know how I feel about it. I think it, because people have been praising this left and right. I just want to be clear about that. And then some people have kind of gone, well, I don't know if it's that good. And I think I'm becoming one of those people.
Right, okay.
I think it's a very interesting film because what it is trying to do, I think in many ways, it sounds like it is the perfect Me Too film, or like it should be for this kind of era. And then I think in many ways, it sometimes oversimplifies the situations that the protagonist finds themselves in. Not that, I don't mean oversimplifying the actions of the men or anything. I think that's very crystal clear. Mm-hmm. But you're kind of led to believe from the trailers and stuff that there may be some kind of physical violence happening towards these men in revenge.
Yeah, it felt like she was like being like a vigilante. That's what it was implied in the trailers.
Yeah, so she's kind of being a vigilante, but not in a violent manner. Okay. So it seems to be that her concept is to get these men in this situation and then basically to make them take a very long, hard look at themselves and realize that they're not as nice as they think they are, which is sort of admirable, but feels quite unrealistic. The fact that suddenly when she flips the table on them, they realize she's not actually drunk, and she kind of says, what are you doing? And, you know, why are you doing this? The fact that she seems to get out of those situations unscathed, as horrible as it is to say, is quite unrealistic.
Right.
It also has a very muddled relationship with authority. I can't go into that an incredible amount because I can't tell you what the ending is. The ending is really divisive, I have to say, and also not an easy watch if you do not have a good stomach for this kind of stuff. I will say for anybody who's like worried about this film showing any kind of sexual violence, they never show that on screen. There is an instance where someone reacts to a portrayal of that violence, but it's never physically shown to you. Which is quite good, actually. I was quite relieved about that because typically in film this can be over dramatized and over fetishized, and it's really really unpleasant.
I mean,
sorry, go on.
Oh, sorry, I was just saying. I'm just thinking because through the advertisement and whatever. I mean, at least what I heard about it, I thought of it whether it was going to be almost a take on, you know, the kind of the 70s, 80s revenge exploitation films. But from what you're saying, even if it makes it slightly weaker in the sense of it being, I suppose, like unrealistic and, you know, not tackling, I don't know, whether it's doing its best job trying to steer away from that exploitation past, you know, not showing the sexual violence and just using it as a platform to say, you know, to state its ideas in a sense where it doesn't need to be supported by, you know, shock, but rather the shock it is in seeing the stuff come through itself. Because I know that in the advertising, I certainly got the idea that it was a takeoff exploitation genre, but But certainly from what you're saying, it sounds much more, you know, both deep and away from that to an extent.
I think what it wants to do is have the aesthetic of an exploitation film.
I was going to say, like, how does it, because the aesthetic seems like very kind of, for something that's about, like, for subject matter that's so horrific and challenging, like this kind of, I don't know how you just, this kind of very kind of, I don't know, I know it's about it, but like kind of garish aspect, very candy coloured.
Oh, it's very bubblegum, yeah.
Yeah, like how does that, how does it work? Does it work or does it not?
I think what they're trying to do with that, and I have yet to read an article about it, but I know that it's starting to appear, is almost like the concept of weaponized femininity. And particularly weaponized white femininity. I can't even get into, oh boy, there's, I just have to say, Laverne Cox, oh, I love her, but she is misused in this film drastically. She is very much a sort of supporting black friend with no aspirations or apparent life of her own to support Carey Mulligan, which I thought was really weak. Mm. Because I never want to see Laverne Cox unused. She's great. You know, but it's really mixed, and I think it's really hard to talk about, as you can probably tell, without kind of spoiling it, and I obviously don't want to. I do think, yeah, it wants to have this kind of like high octane appearance and kind of like the weaponized femininity and the bubblegum and the candy colors and the things that are going to make it really striking, which it is a very striking film to watch. But I don't know kind of to what end it really achieves much in that capacity.
I think it's very interesting that this year, like, this film is kind of, you know, is kind of getting a lot of attention. Yeah. And obviously, as someone who hasn't seen the film, I can't say if it's good or bad. But yeah. I think it's interesting that, like, that this, well, I know it came out in late, it was premiered at late 2019, but you know, released in 2020, that there was another film, you know, about well, you know, you could connect to the Me Too movement, which is The Assistant.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they're about very similar things, but they approach them both, you know, in subject matter and like tonally, like, you know, they're very different, almost night and day. Like Promising Woman seems like very kind of saturated and vibrant and very kind of, I don't know, like, you know, that kind of, you know, it's very, you know, active, but like when I think of The Assistant, which is a great film, it's about the kind of, I don't know, it's a paraphrase, but the banality of evil. Like, it's a very mundane place, like a very mundane job. Our main character, played by Julia Garner, like, it's very mundane. It almost shows like the banality of the evil of people who abuse their power. Yeah. And I think it's maybe because it is such a understated film, like, even though it is, like, if you know, it is very horrifying, like, it's, I don't know, it's maybe that, like, it's gone under the radar, and it's like one of those, like, oh, it's really good, but it's not going to get like award attention or mainstream recognition. But when Promising Young Woman has come out, which, you know, is like, what, like, premiered at Sundance, you know, it's just, for better or worse, divisive, and it's creating conversations and opinion pieces, it's much more flashy, and I think it's a shame. Like, how do we it make, like, the kind of discourse between this and, again, not very many little comparisons made between the two. Like, I was searching, like, anyone, I think it was like a podcast, it's like, how it makes you consider, how do we deal with this subject matter appropriately in film, you know, not just what we show but what we don't show. Like, I said, it's good to see that they didn't just like show, you know, an assault on somebody, but again, like, how, like, both, I don't know, like, like, I think it's a shame. Like, just because I think The Assistant's a great film,
it's incredibly
underappreciated.
I really want to see The Assistant. That had completely kind of flown under my radar, and then just because of Promising Young Woman, that's brought that to my attention, and I'm kind of like, oh, I really want to watch that. I think Promising Young Woman does kind of appeal to mass marketed, particularly American sensibilities. I mean, it's named after, like, you know, what Brock Turner was called, right? You know, this promising young man. You know, these assaulters are called promising young men. Well, what of the women? You know, who are they? What about their promise? And that's really what this film is trying to ask, which is a fair thing to ask. I want to ask it too. I'm with them. But it's just kind of muddled. What I was going to say was that even though they don't show explicit sexual violence, there is a violent scene towards the end of the film that I will say is quite researched and realistic and quite hard to watch. Just warning for that one. Oh, and it has a very muddled opinion of authority. It's very interested in looking at how systems, particularly kind of like a university system or kind of social circles, kind of protect abusers.
Right.
But then something towards the end of the film relies on another form of authority actually pulling through. And I found that very unbelievable, difficult to watch. And I think because, I mean, this film is not prophetic in any way, but obviously it can't be. And, you know, Emerald Fennell, who wrote and directed it, she can't.
Okay, what we're going to do, we can finish off some Promising Young Women chat. What I might do is put on a track and try and sort out the audio issues. It's not quite coming through correctly. So I'm going to put on a track as we get this sorted out, if I can actually find the track. And this is Fight For You by Hair from Judas and the Black Messiah. And it's a fantastic track. And hopefully we can get that sorted out before we come back. So here we go, Fight For You.
URN University Radio Nottingham.
Right, that was a little bit of Fight For You by H.E.R. Her. Hopefully the gremlins are no longer in the wires and we can hopefully hear Lizzie again. I think we can. Hello, Lizzie. Can we hear you again?
Hi.
Great, yeah, I think that's all loud and clear. Right, and we were just finishing off on Promising Young Woman, weren't we? Yes.
Before we were completely interrupted. Yeah, no, I think I was just saying that it does have a muddled sort of view of authority that I think is a little bit underdeveloped, I'll say. It is, however, I will say, in some ways, it has some very... To give it its due, because it is trying.
Right.
To give it its due, it has some really, really clever dialogue, I will say that. There's some really, really great uses of the kind of phrases that people often use to excuse these kind of actions and this kind of behavior that really is quite clever. And I think as well there's some really, really fantastic casting choices. I wasn't super aware of all of them because I don't watch as much American TV as some people apparently, and I didn't know who everybody was. But a lot of the people who are kind of cast in these sort of like quote-unquote nice guy roles are often kind of apparently sort of picked and pulled from sitcoms where they are typically literally the nice guy. So you can watch but in a genuine way that the sitcom really wants you to believe in them. So say you have a couple of male characters in a sitcom and there's one that's a bit dodgy and you go, oh, I don't know about that one. The guys they've got in this film, they're the ones where you go, oh, we love them and they're definitely reliable. We can trust that one. And I think that's really, really critical. So casting of people like Bo Burnham, Max Greenfield, Adam Brody, people like that. It's really, really clever. And similarly, the casting of Connie Britton and Alison Brie in their roles as well. Also, shout out to Alfred Molina, who I didn't know was in this film. He had a great 10 minutes.
It's a reunion between him and Carey Mulligan from An Education.
Yes. I will say, it's got some good casting. It's got some really strong dialogue choices. It's a little bit messy,
right?
But worth a watch to get some of its messaging across, I would say. But maybe do put your critical hats on at times, if that's any kind of sense. I think what worries me, just to end on it, is that it does have a view of experiences of assault in a way that maybe they're not sort of able to be overcome. Now, obviously, I don't say that lightly at all. These are extremely difficult things to deal with and extremely difficult topics, but it does kind of treat them as always life ruining, right, which they are to a point. But I think that does lack the. This is not to excuse anybody, of course. What I'm trying to get at is it kind of lacks the strength of something like I May Destroy You, where it's actually about people having to seek their own closure and take back their own power, because this incident and this person cannot rule the rest of their life. Whereas Promising Young Woman doesn't do that at all. This is like, this has happened and now you are marked forever.
It defines you, right.
Yeah, whereas something like I May Destroy You, which I would just shout out all the time, it's amazing. Really says, yes, you've been marked, and yes, this is extremely difficult, but, you know, now what? And I think it's a really hard thing to talk about and get right.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry if I'm not quite getting it, but Yeah, definitely go check it out for yourselves.
Yeah, and so that's on Now TV, and I think that's up for 5 nominations other than Best Picture as well, so
yep.
We'll see on that. Right, so we've done a track, haven't we? And we're going on to the film that track was from, I think. We're going to have a little chat on Judas and the Black Messiah. Isaac, are you right talking about that?
Yeah, I'm all right to talk about. Shall I give you the plot synopsis?
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Please do.
Yeah, so after attempting to impersonate an officer and steal a car, William O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, is tasked by an FBI informant, played by Jesse Plemons, to infiltrate Fred Hampton, played by Danny Kaluuya, Fred Hampton being the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party in late 60s Chicago.
Hmm.
Cool. That's a good cast.
Yeah, it's got a couple of others as well. Like you got... Also, I will say that Martin Sheen plays J. Edgar Hoover as well.
Okay,
so, that's a bold choice.
Hopefully, as evil as possible.
Oh yeah, they are no bars hold. Like the FBI are essentially they are the villains.
Wow.
Both as individuals and as a system. No, so obviously this is one of two films about Oscar Best Picture nominees about late 60s Chicago. Yes. The other true. Being. Chicago 7, and Bobby Seale does make is mentioned in the film kind of horrifyingly how the FBI, like after an image of him being gagged in court, like the FBI just are just laughing at it, you know, not at the card, but yeah. At this situation. So yeah, as I was saying, so I think I don't want to keep talking on about Chicago 7, because I think this, even though I have big issues with the ending, I don't think I have this like this strong dislike of it, but like that but this film, unlike that, Judas the Black Messiah is a very urgent film. Like it feels very, you know, pot boiling in a sense. Nice. Like it's very like anything can kick off at any point, you know, in all situations, everything is just, you know, on edge. And it's a really interesting film, because I think when people think of the Black Panther Party, they're like, they're usually just loud and militant and wear berets and wear black leather, and that's what it is. And not to say the film doesn't have that, but they kind of show, you know, things that if you read history about the Black Panthers, you know, like whether you agree with their politics or they did things such as, you know, they helped communities, you know, with medicine and education, breakfasts. Yeah, and
absolutely.
Meals for children. So it's not like they're like this. They're not one-dimensional, you know, people. And again, like I know I said, like Riz Ahmed's very reliable, but I think, you know, little Get Out reunion between Keith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya, I think this is their best roles for both of them, actually.
Okay, right.
Like I think what's great, especially about Daniel Kaluuya, not just in this role, but as an actor, like he can simultaneously present confidence, just exude confidence and charisma, you know, that you would maybe expect for somebody in history like Fred Hampton, but he's also extremely vulnerable. Like you can see this sort of clash between these kind of two sides of him, like the, you know, this public side where he's very, you know, passionate and, you know, and political and politicized and just, you know, very, like, you know, kind of rousing the crowds, but you know, like when he's, you know, home alone with, you know, let's say, you know, his partner film, Deborah Johnson, played by Dameek Fishback, you know, he's very shy and coy about things. Not about his views, but just, you know, stuff like, you know, personal stuff, like relationships or intimacy. And I think that's really, like, really just shows, like, why Daniel Kaluuya is one of the best actors working, as well as, like, Lakeith Stanfield, maybe to a lesser extent, but, like, this kind of, like, he feels like he's trapped in this situation, because again, the FBI make him do this, because if he doesn't, you know, kind of infiltrate the Black Panthers, he'll go to jail for impersonating an officer and stealing the car. But again, it's interesting, his character as well, because it's not like, oh, this person who becomes reluctant and then, I don't know, like a story where, like, you know, they go to the other side and then they sympathize and agree and then they fight against, you know, the oppressors, you know, the FBI. Like, it's no, he's actually a very kind of apolitical character. Like, you know, there's kind of a scene where, like, someone asks him, like, how do you feel about, you know, the death of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X? He kind of doesn't really feel anything, like, aside from the fact that, you know, these people die, that's like upsetting, but, like, you know, the importance of these people, like, he doesn't really feel it. And it's interesting, like, you know, like Jesse Plemons, obviously, it's he's obviously he's like works for the FBI are the bad guys both in the movie and in real life, but like it's almost like he's seen as like a father figure for O'Neill. Like O'Neill like kind of aspires to him, not because of his actions, but like what he possesses. You know, he wears a clean suit, and you know, like he's kind of, I don't know, maybe he's kind of enticed by certain things, and not like, you know, just materialistic things like cars and whiskey and cigars and, you know, that's and money, but it's this, like, you know, like he goes to his house and it's kind of this idea of sort of not domesticity but like stability, which he hasn't been able to do. And I think that's what's really interesting about the film, like that's kind of his motivation. It's not like, you know, to get out, you know, not to get out of prison or two. It's kind of this stability he sees that, you know, the FBI kind of represents, but not in this kind of, you know, like kind of how J. Edgar Hoover, you know, it says that the Black Panthers are like, it's almost like the big, not just a war against crime or lawlessness, but like a culture war, this kind of idea of culture war. Just, it's not just what they are, but what they represent in America. And I think the film really kind of gets that across. And it's, you know, and I think these people in history are obviously known and being depicted, maybe in documentary form, but I don't think, you know, even though it's a film, very, very passionate and impassioned film, like it is, you know, still a mainstream film, you know, it has A-list actors, you know, it has a budget. And where was I going with this point? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. The conflict, the hugely complex characters and... I mean, actually, there's one thing I was thinking about of the film itself, whether it, especially with the title, you know, Judas and the Black Messiah, you can see, you know, the allegories and the idea that you can transform this into a simpler story and a simpler structure than it actually was. I wonder what you felt
30 pieces of silver, you know, isn't money, even though he's given money to do the FBI's dirty work. It's just, again, like that idea of stability, which he obviously doesn't have. And there's a line that really clicked with me in the film, which is, I think he says it, like, because someone asked him why he's impersonating an officer. And he says, simply says, a badge is scarier than a gun. And I think that's just a really powerful line. Like, in terms of dialogue, that's the most powerful line for me. That's the line that sticks to it. But also, an interesting dynamic is, you know, we have Jesse Plemons as this FBI informant, but like there's a very, very another scene where it's almost like he's kind of trapped. And what this isn't like to sympathize with his character or the FBI, but like he meets J. Edgar Hoover or his superiors, and he's basically silently threatening like his kids if he doesn't follow orders. Like he mentions like his family, and they just talk about it in sort of generalness, but like you can kind of feel that like he's talking about this because that's what's on the line for him if he doesn't, you know, do his job. It's not just, oh, you'll get fired or something. Like the FBI have the power and the ability to threaten his family and the people close to him.
Yeah, definitely. That's very interesting, because in that aspect, rather than, I mean, we'll talk a bit about Trial of the Chicago 7 a little bit later, maybe only a little bit, but how it was lacking for me there in that analysis of the Black Panther movement. I know, obviously, that's not really what the film was about in that extent.
No, that's what I was going to say. It's a mainstream film, but it doesn't water it down. Yes, like, it doesn't... Like, the film... it is an ugly film. Like, the FBI are ugly pieces of work. You know, they may look clean and sound clean, but they're definitely not that, inside. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of... I think the thing that's this one of those other big villains of the film is guns. There are so many guns, and not just shootouts, but just everyone, like all, you know, these groups, you know, the Black Panthers and others, and the FBI and police, like they all have guns, and it's almost like guns... I don't know, it's obvious, but like guns really escalate the situation, not just because it can kill somebody, but, you know...
I guess, yeah, the symbol
again,
of
what you symbol are, so, yeah. Of authority, yeah.
Of defense,
And it's kind of, and usually for something like contentious, like, you know, like Fred Hampton's, you know, death, like obviously it's known that the FBI either directly or indirectly, well, most likely directly, were involved with, he was a straight up assassinated, you know. But what's not kind of, I don't know, like, because just to spoil a little, like he tries to get Fred Hampton to, like, well, not forcibly, but like, you know, basically put something to put him asleep while the FBI raid where he is and, you know, kill him. So it's like, it just keeps building up and building up. Again, that's kind of pot boiling, like kettling kind of tension in the film. And it's interesting because the way the FBI describes this kind of what would be straight up be murder or assassination, they say, you know, it's not enough to put Hampton in prison. It's to, for him to be neutralized. That's like the polite way they describe what they're going to do. Mm. So it's like, it's almost like the cleanliness is actually very dirty. So I'd also say one last thing. Good score. The good score by Mark Isham and Craig Harris is a very interesting, because it's kind of, it sounds like sort of a mid-century crime and noir film. It's a very jazzy score. Like there's a mixture of sort of jazzy strings and brass. I think, yeah. So I think if you're interested in this period, if you're interested in this period of history and, you know, Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers, I would recommend this. But also, just in general, like obviously it's not going to be completely historically accurate, but it's kind of, it's good to see a mainstream film about someone who hasn't been represented as much in, again, in mainstream film as outside of maybe documentaries. Mm-hmm. And don't treat it as a history lesson, but sort of as a good introduction to, you know, what this is about, like why these people were the way they are and why they did the things they did, you know, and I'm more
the depth of the movement. Yeah.
So, yeah. Also, that one last thing. I noticed there's a gay reunion between Stanfield and Kaluuya, but Lil Tel Howery, who plays, you know, Dan Kaluuya's friend in Gat, he appears in one scene, and it's always great to see him in a movie.
Yeah, and just saying that, so we have best supporting actor for Dan Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. I don't know if how they divvy that up, actually, whether it's best actor and best supporting.
I would say Stanfield is the lead. You know, Clue is the main supporting character, but it is Stanfield's film, really. Yeah. It's from his perspective. It's about his, you know, it's his story.
Right. So whereabouts can we find that, actually?
It's just available across, you know, numerous platforms. There's nothing specific like Amazon or whatever.
Great. Right. So yeah, we tackled those three films that we haven't covered before. Actually, Isaac, have you seen Minari, haven't you? Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Or maybe we could... probably best, because it is, you know...
Let's talk about something we haven't seen. Minari is available to rent on numerous platforms, just to say that straight up. I personally rented it from BFI Player, and if you have a subscription, you can get a little discount. Rather than, I think, instead of £10, it was £8.50. I know it's a bit much, but hey, it's a discount. So, plot is actually kind of simple. It's basically set in early 80s Arkansas in America, and it's about a South Korean family who moved there at that time to simply just start up a crop farm for, like, you know, specific types of vegetables and fruits that would be sold, you know, like, I don't know, something that's more like a store or a food store that's more dedicated to, you know, stuff that's imported from Asia. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting, because Minari, the title, is a type of celery seed that's in the film that grows. So it's actually a rare case, like Promising Young Woman and Judas the Black Messiah. These premiered at Sundance's, both in 2020, 2021. And it's very rare that Sundance films get Best Picture nominations, because usually they're trying to fade away into memory. But unlike, you know, like Get Out was the exception, but this year, maybe because of things not getting released as much, like these films get more attention. It's not because, whether you agree or disagree, it's good to see that films from earlier in the year get as much attention as stuff from later in the year. And also the Ryan director, Lee Isaac Chung, along with Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, which I still want to see. It's the first year where two filmmakers of Asian descent are nominated for best director in the same year, so that's good that they're getting that act together. I think of all the films that I had to see, for this show, and all the Best Picture nominees as of now, I think it might be my favorite. Right, and I think the reason why is because it's for something that's about the struggles of, you know, not just, you know, raising a farm, but, you know, trying to keep your family together. It's a very tranquil film. It reminded me a lot of one of my favorite films, Paris, Texas, even though very different films. But what it reminds me of is that the film, the core of the film, you know, Stephen Young, who's sort of he's the patriarch of the family. Mm-hmm. Jacob Yee is his name. And they're both films are about patriarchs who buy land, you know, whether it be for raising a farm or to, you know, just to live. And it's this kind of, it's not just about, it's not that having this isn't just to make, you know, make a living, but to keep the, to have the families be closer. And both films are about the struggles of living up to familial archetypes. Like, sort of in the first act, we have the grandma, played by, who it's like, she's a grandma, but she doesn't, she's not a typical grandma. Like the little kid, the little son, Alan Kim. Alan Kim, the actor. She doesn't live up to this kind of what's expected of a grandma. Like, he says, why doesn't grandma make cookies? And she just doesn't make cookies. You know, she swears and she does all these kind of things. That's kind of it's not stereotypical of a grandma. But also, again, Lee Isaac Chung, this is about, you know, a South Korean family living in America, you know, and Paris, Texas it has a kind of combination. Like, certain characters in that film of French descent, Wim Wenders, who was, you know, is a German filmmaker. So it's almost this clash of two continents in a film for this ideal of America, like the American landscape. And the film, when I think about the film, like, it's kind of similar to Paris, Texas, that when I think of this film, I think of American colors, like red, blue, and green. You know, both Harry Dean Stanton's character and, you know, Stephen Young both wear red caps, but there's it's the greenery. Like, it's a very green, it's almost green as used as a symbol of, like, you know, of sort of flourishing kind of nature and all sorts of things. And I think that's what I like. And also, even though it's kind of maybe not, is even less direct, now there's a Japanese filmmaker called Yasuo Ozu, who's very well known for having very tranquil films also. And he has, you know, there's a lot of low shots, you know, like if there was a tripod, it'd be a very low, sort of not looking up low, but just having it straight on. It's almost, it's pillow shots. Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of domesticity in the way it's shot, even sort of in sort of comfortableness in sort of in both interior and exterior shots. And I think what made me click with this film, it's not an all-encompassing thing, but there was a scene that really clicked with me. So it's the first scene where you meet Monica Yee, who's the wife of Jacob. She's finally reunites with her grandma. You know, I think she came in from South Korea, and they kind of tear up because they haven't seen each other for so long. And it's a very simple scene, but I think the reason why I was choking up a little, even though this introduction to these characters, was that it's about, you know, it's two people. It's about two people reuniting after so long not being together. And I think with COVID, I think that resonated with me more, like not being able to see, you know, family and friends, you know, physically as much, if not at all. And it's just, I don't know, like it's very much, I think that's what the film is about. It's about family and about the struggles to live up to sort of, not just familial kind of archetype, but American familial archetypes, you know, like not just to be a father or a father figure, but to be, raise the alpha, if you want to quote of Mice and Men, and be this kind of strong, both emotionally and physically. And Stephen Young is like, it's not much dialogue, but you kind of really feel this sort of struggle that, because the farm doesn't, you know, the farm has some success, but it's not a complete success. They have issues, and it's kind of this struggle. And also, I think that's kind of one of the reasons why him and his wife are, you know, have kind of arguments in the film, because they have all these sort of juggling plates, you know, like their son has a heart condition. And it's funny, in the film, they depict like the Mountain Dew as like the dew from the mountains rather than being this radioactive waste that it is. I think if you want a film that's a little quieter than a lot of the Best Picture nominees, I would recommend this. And also, shout out to the score by Amel Mosseri, because even though this isn't my favorite score by them, it's still a good score. But the reason why I want to shout out is because a couple of years ago they did a score for The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which, aside from being one of the best films of recent years, it's actually one of the best scores. I mean, they're such a great composer. And if you listen to Last Black Man in San Francisco, you'll really understand, because that score is just, you can't describe how good it is. So I would really recommend Mirari if you're into that sort of thing. And again, it should be available on most streaming platforms.
And that's up for 6 nominations, as well as the original score and Best Picture.
Yes.
Best Picture. Right, I'm going to kind of open up slightly more just to talk about some of the remaining, you know, films we have. So I know We haven't seen all of the Best Picture nominees because they're simply not out. But I wanted to say also on the Best Adapted Screenplay, I know I've done a review of it, but White Tiger's there, and I say just go watch that. It's on Netflix, and it's surprising for me because of how much I liked it. It's not in Best Picture, but watch it and have a look at that. I mean, it's probably not the best. It's not the archetypical Best Picture film, to be honest, but for me, it was one of the best out there. And I'm just having a bit more of a look. I know we're going to close off the show with a track from Eurovision Ice and Fire. Sorry,
yes.
Fire Saga, even, which is a fantastic little track. I haven't actually watched the film, but this track is just so brimming with that Eurovision energy.
The film's ridiculous. Go and watch it. I absolutely loved it, but I love Eurovision. And to be fair, it came out the year where we didn't have actual Eurovision because of the pandemic. So it felt a little bit like a little piece of Eurovision was given back. It was lovely.
Yeah, and obviously on the Best Picture, we also have, I know we didn't talk about it too much, but Mank and the Trial of Chicago 7. I know, Lizzie, you gave up during Mank, and I
gave up, sorry.
But honestly, you know, looking back on it, yeah, it was very muddled. I think we're using muddled for Promising Young Woman. But
yeah, I wasn't on the show, but I like as a big fan of David Fincher, and you know, Citizen Kane and that era of Hollywood history, it was just all right. It was a bit of a disappointment, even though it had some
scraps. Awards, so there we go. Well done, Academy Awards, for putting probably one of the most mediocre ones of the Best Picture category getting the most nominees and might probably win because it's a film about films.
Maybe it'll be like La La Land, where actually last minute they'll give it to something they open, it's like, no, it's actually Nomadland or something like that, you know.
Yeah, and hopefully we're gonna do reviews of Nomadland, The Father, and I think that's all from the Best Picture category.
Yes.
Which would be nice. Has anybody else got anything to say about these coming up Academy Awards?
Oh, I want to say it's funny that Glenn Close is nominated for Hillbilly Elegy because she simultaneously has an Oscar nomination and a Razzie nomination for the same role.
That's incredible.
I actually oddly want to see that film eventually because I heard it is so bad and so over the top. Like, it's like, I don't know, someone described it as like, it's almost like when people parody the Oscars. Like a Tropic Thunder or something. Like, this is the film that they would do.
Screaming matches and just
yeah, it over the top makeup, and you know, it relates to the present moment, man. That's what I am very much looking forward to.
There's too many absolutely shockers in here. I think we all kind of knew Mank was going to be there, and Trigger 7. It was always going to be up there, even if they're not the best. If they're just kind of okay.
Yeah. I would say Trial of Chicago 7, please, if you watch it, go and actually read what actually happened at the end.
Yeah, watch other documentaries. There's more interesting things about the case.
Yeah, because really interesting stuff happened and they changed the ending for no reason.
So, yeah, I was all on board. I'm like, oh no, I understand why people don't like it, but I like it. But in the end, they just deflate all that kind of, you know, like devil's advocate in me. I will say it is weird that we're doing the Oscars this year. Like, I think personally, a lot of people complain about the Oscars, like, oh, they never get it wrong. They often get it wrong, and they never have, like, you know, and usually certain films in retrospect seem more deserving. It would have been amazing if they didn't cancel the Oscars, but they waited an entire other year. So, like, people could sort of, you know, kind of, I don't, what's the right word, kind of soak in what the films of that year, and then, you know, maybe if all the nominations they were, you know, the things that would win would be more deserving or more understandable, you know. And I know that's obviously would never happen, but it would have been interesting if they just said, we're just going to do the next couple of years of Oscars all in like a couple of days, rather than, you know, kind of struggling and pushing through with COVID and, you know, being all these different changes, you know.
It'll be really
interesting to see how they put it off, because even at best it will be okay, but at worst it will be a dumpster fire, and I'll very much look forward to it.
We'll see whether it's an Aaron Sorkin Aaron Sorkin and Mank clean sweep. That will be really kind of hit me quite hard in the heart.
No, I think... I know the voters aren't the smartest people, but I think I think slow but surely they're trying. Some places they're getting their stuff together.
They're doing their best.
Oh, sorry, I should also make a quick correction. I think I said Lucky Sunfield and Kalua were kind of actor and supporting actor. They're both actually in supporting actor. So
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It makes no sense because Stanfield is a lead. You know.
Yes, yeah. Right. Yeah, I think that's all we've got to talk about on these Oscars. Yeah. And
Look forward to the aftermath talking about that.
Definitely. I think just to close out as well, if no one minds, I think we should just very quickly say that obviously it's been deeply saddening to hear about Helen McCrory this past week. And I think because we talk about this when other people die, like we did this for Christopher Plummer when he died. If you haven't seen a Helen McCrory film, by all means, go and watch one, please. Such a huge light. I think we've all enjoyed her work at some point.
And I would highly recommend a performance in the National Theatre production of Deep Blue Sea.
Highly recommend the National Theatre of Medea. So yes, she seemed to love theatre, and I think you should definitely go and check her out.
Rest in
peace.
If
you haven't already, indeed.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and maybe in a bit of a tonal shift, we're going to finish off with that.
Yeah, sorry.
But no, definitely, no. It's worth saying that because, was it a big impact in the film industry and obviously in the theatre industry. But we're going to finish off with that track from the Eurovision film, which is Husavik, I think it's hometown. But we're going to say our quick goodbyes and hopefully, we'll try and recuperate from the Oscars in our next show, which should be next Wednesday, 6 p.m. Of course, also on our podcast. And you can see the podcast where we talked a bit about Mank and Trial of the Chicago 7 on that. But yeah, we'll hopefully see you, whether it's online or over the airwaves, next Wednesday. So yeah, it's a goodbye from me, and I hope you have a good rest of your week.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
This is University Radio Nottingham.